Thank you all for coming, and thanks especially to William for the invitation to speak on this platform. I'm going to speak for about an hour, right? And then we'll have questions and answers after that. Is that what you plan? Yeah, good. So my talk has four sections. I want to give you an overview, a brief overview or review of the national student protests that took place from 2015 to 2017. Then to say something about what does decolonization mean in the UCT context, and it's going to be different, of course, in different contexts, but what were the issues in the UCT environment? And then the main part of the talk is to recount four encounters or examples which exemplify some of the dilemmas raised by decolonization debates and incidents during those protests, and will be ongoing issues, and finally some summary or takeaway messages. So let me start with some context for this lecture. Chair said, I was Vice Chancellor of the University of Cape Town for 10 years, from 2008 to 2018. During the first 7 years of that period, the university was a relatively untroubled space. In fact, it was on something of a high, experiencing growth, improved performance in all the metrics that generally we use for universities, greater research output, more research grants, more international partnerships, more postdoctoral and master's students, the perceived global status measured in rankings, if you pay attention to them, showed a significant improvement over the period, and also doing really well in measures that are more parochial or more important to the local environment, such as recruiting more black students, more students from disadvantaged backgrounds, and addressing as many of the transformation issues that have been present since for decades. In fact, all these trends continued throughout the 10 years, but my experience was very much coloured by the last 3 years of my term, 2015 to 2017, which were marked by sustained and disruptive protests across the tertiary sector in South Africa. I would say these were there was nothing on this scale in the 20 years since the end of the apartheid era. The protests were national, affecting every campus in the country. I think they were not dissimilar in a way to the riots and protests that rocked Europe and American campuses in 1968, in terms of the trauma that they dealt both to the universities and to society more generally. But the issues at stake varied across the universities and across time, depending on the local context. On all the campuses, the campaign for free higher education has been a driving factor as a national policy issue. This was the so-called hashtag Fees Must Fall campaign. At historically liberal white English universities, the major focus was decolonization under the banner hashtag Roads Must Fall. At Afrikaans language universities, it was largely about changing the medium of instruction from Afrikaans to English, which was regarded as the first step in a decolonization process and also critical to the demographic transformation of those campuses which were not attracting African students because of the language policy. At historically black campuses, the long-standing crises in student accommodation and in financial aid were a primary focus. On many campuses, workers employed by outsourced contractor companies, such as cleaning, security, and catering, allied themselves to the student protests to call for insourcing. That is, that they should be directly employed by the universities. At most universities, there were also smaller, more focused student campaigns which allied themselves to the main RMF and FMF, Roads Must Fall and Fees Must Fall campaigns, broadening the agenda and the demands of the protests. These related to sexual assault and rape, mental health and suicide, disability and patriarchy, gender identity, and cis-heteronormativity. I suspect none of this would have reached boiling point were it not located in the context of national politics of unfulfilled expectations 20 years after liberation. Inequality in society has increased, and most black people have not experienced the economic fruits of political liberation. The school system available to most black children is in crisis, and the majority of school leavers are not adequately prepared for university. In addition, political parties all have youth branches on the campuses, which dominate the student representative councils, the student unions. The national political party contestation, which has been so heightened in the last 5 to 8 years, including the factionalization of the ruling party, is mirrored on the campuses and often informs protest politics. The student political party branches escalate issues like the high cost of education as a mobilizing tactic to win support away from the ANC-aligned student organizations, which then respond by trying to demonstrate that they are more radical or more militant than their critics. And finally, compounding the many intersecting agendas that I've described, there has also been a rediscovery by the Born Free generation, in other words, the current students born around 1994, of writers like Frantz Fanon. A particular reading of one strand of Fanon's argument on decolonization has caught their imagination, namely, that there can be no true transfer of power and no real decolonization without a violent revolution. Absent a violent revolution, the old regime and power relations persist into the post-colonial period. Into the post-colonial period by co-opting a small number of previously oppressed to the class interests of the colonialists, and little changes for the majority. But for some, this is a convenient and effective explanation of the current political dynamics in South Africa. South Africa's peaceful transition to democracy, they believe, came at the expense of decolonization and any significant redistribution of power. These revolutionary readers of Fanon believe that violence is necessary for its own sake, that the institutions of colonialism must be destroyed before one can rebuild a new decolonized society. Burning the institutions is seen as the necessary price to pay. I hasten to add that this is not a large or dominant group among the protesters, but it does not take many to burn a library or a bus, and it changes the strategy for managing protests, because from the perspective of university management, because no amount of negotiation to address the underlying grievances can change the desire for violence in this particular subgroup. Since the end of 2017, the situation at UCT and on most campuses in the country has stabilized, and there have been few further protests, not none at UCT, though I do expect there will be more because many of the issues persist and they are only partially addressed. Looking back over this period, this three-year period of tumultuous protest, some will say these protests scarred the institution. Some will say they energized it. Some will say they were a tipping point that finally broke the back of a passive resistance or apathy towards decolonization and transformation. Others will say they created a racial polarization on campuses and set back by a decade or two the progress that had been made towards non-racial integration. Some will say they have created cracks in the previously monolithic, hegemonic Eurocentric culture of the university that made black people feel that they did not belong at UCT. Others will say the protests have created a toxic environment in which many people feel alienated by identity politics and political correctness in the name of inclusivity. All of these are right in some measure. My bottom line is that this rupture had to come sometime, that the boil had to be lanced before healing and change could occur, and that the lancing process was going to be painful for almost everyone, but that it was necessary and worthwhile, and that the institution will be in a much stronger place in the future as it heals and grows, based on a changed set of ground rules, and in the process shaping a new identity. People often ask me whether I don't wish that I had ended my term after 7 years, seven biblical good years, before the protest started. And my response is always that I feel privileged, actually, to have had the opportunity to steward the university through this period of challenge and change. But challenging and often unnerving it was, for sure. It certainly pushed the edges of my ability as a leader and manager, with many difficult and complex choices, sometimes on a daily basis, accompanied by lots of self-doubt and hesitation. And it is this that I want to highlight in this talk. The difficulties typically arose from having to manage a range of interests, pressures, and values, often conflicting and sometimes in outright contradiction, and often without the luxury of time for wide consultation and slow deliberation. The challenge for leaders during such times is first and foremost to ensure that the institution survives, something that cannot and should not be taken for granted. Second, one has to hear and understand the causes of the protests, not just the immediate grievances that triggered the eruption, but the underlying long-term factors, and to discern the different agendas, such as the Fanonian, the political party, politicking, the adolescent rebellion against authority, and the real material hardships and psychological traumas. Third, it is to find ways of responding constructively while balancing the interests of a large number of stakeholders that exist in a public university. Stakeholders such as the students and their parents, staff, alumni, the government, donors, research teams, and other institutional partners. At every point, one is trying to decide not just what is the right thing to do for each of the stakeholders, but what will strengthen the institution in the long term. Given the scale and scope of the 3 years of protests, I do need to say what this talk is not about, largely because of time. What I want to share with you are some personal experiences of dilemmas that were thrown up specifically under the theme of decolonization during these turbulent times. But what the talk will not cover is even a fraction of the issues that drove the protests. No mention of the funding of higher education and fees, of the gender politics, disability or mental health. I'm not going to be able to talk about worker-student alliances and the pros and cons of insourcing. I'm also not going to cover the debates about what are the legitimate boundaries of protest and disruption, and when management should tolerate protesters overstepping those boundaries, which has been a key issue over the 3 years. I will not be able to discuss how university management should manage unlawful protests that affect the rights of other members of the university community, or the use of police and private security and the courts. And I'm also not going to offer an analysis of the academic debates about decoloniality, curriculum reform, and identity politics. As I said, this talk will focus on issues raised under the theme of decolonization, and will do so by way of four examples related to decolonization that the protests at UCT threw up. The challenges for me were perhaps more personally taxing, certainly ethically and politically. My own activist inclinations, given those inclinations, I found myself often in the position of agreeing with most of what the student protesters were campaigning for. But the methods of protest and direct action taken by students to advance their causes often overstepped what I considered the bounds of legitimate protest. They also rejected the governance processes for making policy changes that would take account of other stakeholders in the university community. So I found myself in the position of having to push back, often, against the protests, even when agreeing with their goals. So what is meant by decolonization at UCT? I'm moving to the second, having reviewed the protests, to look at the second issue, what in this context it means. The way that the debates manifest on a South African historically white, culturally English campus are typified at UCT. UCT, the University of Cape Town, was founded in 1829 under British colonial rule. The university is 190 years old and so has entrenched the traditions of that history. And it continues until the present day broadly to embody and aspire to the culture, values, and traditions of European higher education institutions. This extends from the neoclassical architecture of the university to the Oxbridge type cloistered residences, to the sense of elite status which the university takes pride in and boasts about, taking pride in being part of a global club of elite universities. And I do want to say elite doesn't mean elitist, but a group of universities that sees itself in the top, on the top rung. In fact, it was not unusual for representatives of the university, including students, to refer to UCT as the Harvard or Oxford of Africa. That was the unashamed aspiration. It sees itself as similar to other cosmopolitan universities with an international identity. For example, 30% of the doctoral students are from other countries, and about 20% of the academic staff. And it sees itself as pursuing and addressing global problems rather than a provincial university serving primarily the needs of the nation and local community. Now, I hasten to emphasize that local impact is critically important, but it is balanced, as in all top universities, with global impact, fundamental science, questions which will affect all of humanity and our natural environment equally. The university was thus created in the image of the colonizers' universities, and it still measures itself against their standards. Degrees must be internationally accredited, theses marked also by international examiners, articles internationally peer-reviewed, and where appropriate, partnering with researchers, international researchers as co-authors. And that is generally valued by all. That is why the top students, white and black, from all over the continent, want to get into UCT and compete to get into UCT. That is also why the top students, wanting to pursue graduate study abroad, often regard Oxbridge and Harvard as the prize, including, by the way, many of the students who were hashtag must fall protesters and leaders of the protest at the time. But it is also the source of ambiguous feelings about their alma mater and anxiety, because it implies a valorization of the history and culture of the colonizers and of those who still dominate the academic ranks of the institution today. And it goes along with an invisibilization of other cultures and traditions and ways of seeing the world. The symbolism of the university reflects its history. The statues honor founders and donors, all white, mostly men. The names of buildings likewise honor a past where the academy, the academic and political leaders and donors to the university were white men. It must be said that there had been a conscious project over the last two decades to name buildings in honor of black role models and cultural values, but the numbers so named are still few. And what had not been considered was the removal of names that were already in existence. The art and sculptures tend to reflect the accumulation over centuries of the work of artists who were, of course, predominantly white. There were also considerable numbers of paintings and photographs that actually depicted the inequalities and indignities of apartheid as a statement of injustice, usually all produced by anti-apartheid artists and photographers. But as seen by contemporary black students who often did not know the context of these artworks, these served only to undermine their self-esteem. A black student leader wrote in 2014, and I'm quoting, "I have noted two broad themes being recurrent in UCT's paintings, poverty of black people and the naked black body, more so the genitalia of black men. These artworks reinforce the inferiority complex of the black student," he said, "while concurrently reaffirming the superiority complex of the white student." End quote. The portraits in the corridors and public halls are of chancellors, vice chancellors, deans, professors, who again are mostly white men. The photos on the walls of the residences are of house committees and student society committees, which again are largely of white students. As the same student wrote, quote, granted some of the portraits are not demeaning and humiliating in and of themselves, but concern is not generally with the individual portraits, but with the message the collective paintings are saying about someone of my pigmentation, end quote. The colonial traditions continued through the ceremonial activities of the university, the academic dress, the pageantry of graduations, the singing of Gaudiamus in Latin, amongst others. And then there are the critiques of the curricula. These range from content that ignores locally important issues to reading lists that imply that all authority on a subject is Western. The university was certainly vulnerable to criticism that it offered a menu of Romance languages and Mandarin, classical Latin and Greek, but not Kiswahili, and even many indigenous South African languages were missing. And that many courses and reading lists included mainly intellectual authorities from the global north, but not from Africa or the global south more generally. But more profoundly, the decolonization protagonists challenge the presentation of a Western worldview and framing of questions as if that were a global norm, rather than just one among several framings available. Indeed, the decolonization movement in universities in the global north tends to have its primary focus on curriculum reform. These are much more blurry and contested critiques, I think everywhere, but certainly in the UCT environment. So these colonial legacies obviously overlay racially aligned cultures, languages, histories, worldviews, and therefore the experience of being a black student in a university like UCT. The experience for many has been that their own cultures and languages were not recognized or valorized, that excellence was associated with whiteness, that they were not good enough, and that they needed to assimilate into the dominant traditional culture of the university. Decolonization at UCT is the attempt to change this experience. So now I want to turn to the four examples that I'm going to cover, and they are the Rhodes statue, the removal of the Rhodes statue, debates around the artworks, cultural practices, and some comment on decolonizing the curriculum. Many of you will be familiar with what has become an iconic image of the removal of the statue of Cecil John Rhodes. This was the start of the 3 years of protests. It began with one student supported by two others on the 9th of March, 2015, throwing human feces over the statue. They called for the statue to be removed, arguing that it represented white power, colonial oppression, the lack of transformation on the campus, and an insult to black students whose ancestors had suffered from Rhodes's policies, legislation as Prime Minister of the Cape, imperial annexations of territory, and military conquests. The hashtag Rhodes Must Fall movement was born. The statue was the perfect lightning rod for this protest, because it symbolizes the particular heritage which has been hegemonic at UCT, which captures white privilege and white supremacy as the underlying ethos of colonialism, the dominance of the English language, the superiority of European culture, all the things that feed the experience of being black at UCT. I was immediately sympathetic to the demand to remove the statue. In fact, in a speech the previous year in 2014, I had said that the university ought to consider and reconsider the appropriateness of the statue. Our plan, the executive's plan for 2015, was to review the controversial yet apparently untouchable icons and names of buildings and subject them to critical debate. This explicitly included the Rhodes statue and Jamison Hall. Jamison, I'm sure most of you know, was one of Rhodes' sort of lieutenants and supporters. I had not acted before that speech in 2014 or after, because I did not think there was enough support for this on the campus and that it would be hugely divisive. And when the topic was raised, indeed, it was hugely divisive. While many supported removing the statue, many more believed statues should not be removed in principle, and that this amounted to airbrushing history, and that this was just the beginning of a process that would end with the wholesale destruction of the heritage of the past. In fact, even the democratically elected ANC government did and still does espouse a national policy on monuments and memorials that is opposed to the removal of statues. And I had a number of calls at the time from people senior in government saying that we should not agree to having the statue taken down. Furthermore, the land on which UCT is built was bequeathed by Rhodes in his will. So there were many who argued that UCT could not now dishonour its most significant benefactor. Not only should the institution recognise its indebtedness to Rhodes, but it should recognise the message it would send to current and future donors, that a commitment to honour them in recognition of their beneficence could be overturned in the future. We experienced vehement anger on the part of many donors, alumni, parents and students who opposed even opening a debate on the removal, arguing that it had nothing to do with what they thought of Rhodes the man, but it was the principle of removing statues and dishonouring people who were benefactors of the university or removing recognition of their benefaction. There can be no denying that the student protests took us by surprise, with the timing of their eruption, their passion, and the breadth of support they garnered. This overtook the pace of our original plans. But given that the views of the executive on the Rhodes statue were actually aligned with the cause of the protest, there seemed to be no point in creating a conflict where there ought not to be one. There was, however, a conflict about process, with the students arguing that the statue should come down simply because they felt offended by it, and that it should come down immediately with no further ado. In the students' view, or in the protesters' view, it wasn't only students, also staff members, some staff members. In the protesters' view, management, most whites, most alumni, and donors could not be expected to understand their pain in this regard. So we simply had to accept it. There was nothing to be discussed. For the university management and council, which I should emphasize had many black members, the crucial issue was to defend the idea of a university as a space where ideas and debate matter, where decisions are made rationally, not as a result of populist pressure, nor on the grounds that personal experience places an issue beyond debate by those who don't share that experience, and where proper governance processes were adhered to. This meant that the decision had to be taken by the university council, informed by the arguments presented by different key constituencies. This is essentially what was done. We scheduled a special council meeting to be held 1 month later, and we committed to conducting debates and soliciting views from all constituencies within that period to inform the council's decision. Meanwhile, the protesters, including some staff members, occupied the main administration building of the university, which is in the photograph, for a month while these consultations were going on. And we decided to allow them to do so in spite of the severe disruption this caused, rather than create further confrontation, and recognizing that this was not actually a contest over the goal, not with the executive at any rate. We also had to provide security to the statue from being pulled down. This shows you a picture of the statue, the statue was sort of continuously under attack of one form or another. Here you can see it wrapped up in rubbish bags and covered in tape. But we had to, because there were regular rumours of a tow truck and a chain coming in the middle of the night that would to pull the statue down, which would easily have been able to do so. And if this had happened, in my view, it would have sabotaged the whole process, both by probably forcing us to react and perhaps restore the statue to its plinth, but also making it harder to shift the attitudes of those who were opposed to the removal, and who were at least to some extent consoled by the fact that there was a process of consultation and due process taking place. In many fora, just by the way, the boards that you see there were boards that were put up to invite people to express their views and share their opinions, although most of that happened online through online fora. In many fora, including Senate, Convocation, and Council, it was clear at the start of each debate that not only were views much divided, but in most cases, I expected the majority to be opposed to the removal of the statue. And yet, by the end of those debates, the arguments in favour of removal, often most persuasively presented by the student representatives, prevailed, and there was almost unanimous support for the removing the statue. There was the one exception to that was the alumni group that went bent. Haven't got time for the details. What were the main compelling arguments in favour of removing the statue? I don't think it's necessary here to elaborate Rhodes's problematic values and deeds. These have been widely covered, and few still think that his virtues outweighed his vices. But more importantly, we should be clear that in spite of this, the argument that won the day and that achieved consensus was not that the statue should be destroyed, nor that it should be, or that it should not be accessible to the public in a public place. In my view, there are very few people that think that another statue of Cecil Rhodes, which is in the Company Gardens next to Parliament, should be removed. The argument has been entirely about the location of the statue on the UCT campus and the symbolism of that location. That's the picture of the campus from afar, and if this works... No, it didn't work. Well, just to be... In case you can't see it, there's the... The statue is over there in the centre, and it's in this sort of amphitheatre, the focal point of the campus. The statue was, to all intents and purposes, the only statue of its kind on the campus, an imposing grand statue of an individual signifying veneration and the extolment of his values and achievements. The location in pride of place on Jammy Steps, at the focal point of the magnificently built landscape of the upper campus, communicated that Rhodes was emblematic of UCT, thus signalling much more about UCT than it did about Rhodes. It presented him as a founder and a hero. While he did donate the land upon which the university was built, he was born a quarter of a century after UCT was founded, so he certainly wasn't the founder, and he died a quarter of a century before UCT moved on to the land that he bequeathed, which he hadn't bequeathed specifically for UCT anyway. So those two arguments were not strong arguments, but the main thing was that it was saying something about the university's values. Thirdly, the proposal to remove the statue from its current location was certainly not an attempt to airbrush Rhodes out of UCT's history, as some were claiming. For one, historical memory does not simply depend on or require retaining statues of the old without relocation or contextualization. Moreover, the plinth that remains at UCT may well be contextualized with the story of the statue that was once upon it and why it was removed, arguably as interesting an account of history as that offered by the statue in the past. Fourthly, removing the Rhodes statue from its central location at UCT was an important symbolic gesture of a decisive rupture with the past, because it signalled that, as a community, we recognised how divisive its presence had become. The process of mobilising the overwhelming majority of the campus to support taking the statue down, and the event itself, and you see here a picture of it, and what, although it's not as clear, but I'm sure you can still see that, was a hugely multiracial group. This was not a protest in the end supported primarily by black students and staff. It won support across the campus. This was a very celebratory activity and event. the process of mobilizing this majority and many different groups on the campus to support this was itself symbolic and signaled a change in attitudes on the campus. The removal was followed by the establishment of task teams to look at symbols and statues across the university, and another to look at the names of buildings. Whereas in the past, as I mentioned, new names reflecting transformation were only allocated to buildings that had not been formally named before, the task team was now empowered to solicit views on names that should be removed from buildings. The renaming of Jamison Hall, which had been part-funded by the Friends of Jamison after his death, again raised the issue of under what circumstances can one change names that are bequeathed by people no longer around to grant permission or dispute the change, and what does this say for other donors? Many opposed the renaming, but I believe it will contribute to a greater sense of inclusiveness. I don't have time to talk in more detail about that, but I think it has a whole lot of interesting stories associated with that itself. Incidentally, the hashtag RMF movement triggered a re-examination not only of our colonial legacy in South Africa, but also around the world, and particularly in the USA. On campuses where historically oppressed minorities are now achieving a critical mass, empowering them to find their voices, similar campaigns have been waged to make the alienating institutional cultures more inclusive. Heritage symbols, names, and statues are being challenged, and the invisibility of those who suffered, resisted, and overcame race-based or slavery-based systems of power is being highlighted. So, for example, Harvard Law School decided in 2016 that its crest should be replaced because it included the coat of arms of Isaac Royall Jr., a cruel slave owner who had endowed a nest egg for the Harvard Law School in the 1780s. Incidentally, that campaign also had the same moniker, hashtag RMF, Royall must fall. Yale University named Calhoun College, renamed Calhoun College, one of the residential colleges, replacing the name of an alumnus remembered as an advocate of slavery. At the University of North Carolina, the officials renamed a hall that had honored a leader of the Ku Klux Klan. At Princeton, university leaders chose not to remove the name of Woodrow Wilson, as protesters had demanded, but they pledged to be transparent about his failings, such as his support for segregation. Similar campaigns and outcomes have taken place on numerous campuses across the United States, and as you all know, there was a similar campaign here, although unsuccessful, to remove the Rhodes statue from Oriel College. So that was the first example and the dilemmas it throws up, both about what to do, the substance of the issue, and the process issues, and the role of an executive in that. As already indicated, we're looking at the artworks now, many black students and staff experience the aggregate of artworks and portraits that look back at them from the university's walls as communicating a message about racial hierarchies, and it makes them feel that they, as individuals, and their cultures and histories are not valued or respected. The debates about how to deal with this began in 2015 as part of the hashtag RMF and continued within the task teams. Yet in February 2016, amidst a protest about insufficient accommodation for students who were returning at the start of the academic year, the protest suddenly escalated and protesters invaded neighboring buildings, took down portraits and paintings, and set them alight in the Central University Plaza. Ironically, amongst the paintings burned were a collection, the one on top of that pile is one of them, were a collection of paintings by UCT's first black fine arts graduate, which speaks to the ignorance of the protesters about what they were targeting or whose portraits were being torched. But it also speaks to the point that it was less about the individual artworks and more about the aggregate effect, in a sense, the curation of the artworks. The university, as you would expect, was in a state of shock following this protest, both from the image of the bonfire of the paintings and its connotations of fundamentalism anti-intellectualism, ethnic purification, but also because of the anger that it apparently revealed. There was no official policy at UCT on the public curation of artworks. The university has an impressive art collection, but no dedicated gallery, so the artworks are displayed throughout the campus. We were caught off guard and had to react quickly. The issue immediately proved controversial and intensely divisive, for entirely understandable reasons. The Works of Art Committee quickly identified about 70 artworks on display in public spaces that were likely to be considered offensive by some black students and removed them for safekeeping, that being the first responsibility of the committee to protect and safeguard the university's art collection. This, not surprisingly, generated an enormous global backlash against the university's authorities, that UCT was censoring art simply because it was considered offensive by one particular group. Various artists whose works were removed or covered expressed their dismay at the university's handling of the issue. There are far too many issues and debates on the whole handling of the artworks controversy to cover here, so I want to focus on one particular artwork around which there has been much controversy to illustrate just some of the dilemmas. This is the sculpture of Sarah Bartman. Sarah Bartman was born in the 1770s. She was a South African Khoi Khoi woman who, due to her large buttocks, was exhibited as a freak show attraction in 19th century Europe, as you see from this sketch. She was exhibited under the name Hottentot Venus. In 1810, she went to England with her employer, so she'd been in South Africa, of course. In 1810, at the age of about 35, she went to England with her employer and an English doctor, and just incidentally, her employer himself was a freed black slave. They sought, the employer and the doctor, to show her for money on the London stage. In 1814, she was brought to Paris and sold to an animal trainer who made her amuse onlookers. Bartman lived in poverty and died in Paris about 18 months later. After her death, the professor of comparative anatomy dissected her body and displayed her remains. For more than a century and a half, visitors to the Museum of Man in Paris could view her brain, skeleton, and genitalia, as well as a plaster cast of her body. Her remains were finally returned after some to-ing and fro-ing, returned to South Africa in 2002. As you enter the university library, you pass the sculpture of Sarah Bartman, made of welded tools and bicycle parts, brutish, crude, and powerful. She stands life-size, naked, with her exaggerated buttocks. You might well think that the artist was caricaturing her sexuality if you did not know what she really looked like, and especially if you did not know that the sculptor, Willy Bester, is black and claims some Khoi Khoi ancestry. He is, of course, bemoaning the cruelty shown to Bartman. But if, like most passers-by, you don't pay attention to the explanatory plaque next to the sculpture, you might think at worst that this is institutional racism and sexism, reproducing the very humiliation that Sarah Bartman experienced over two centuries before in Europe. At best, it may be viewed as reflecting an unquestioning indifference of the institution to whether our students, particularly women students, and especially those of Khoi Khoi origin, with similar physiognomy, experience embarrassment or shame through her naked presence in the entrance to the library, where thousands of students pass her every day. Over the next 2 years, the sculpted body of Sarah Bartman became a site of struggle. Some women put robes on the sculpture to cover its nakedness. Others occasionally removed the robes surreptitiously, provoking protests at the disrobing. Here you see the sculpture disrobed again and a protest taking place in front of it. But within a short time again, The sculpture was usually robed. Various published articles accused the authorities, quote unquote, which means me and my colleagues, the authorities of covering the statue. But actually, we did nothing of the sort because we just didn't know what to do. I suppose you could say that we, the authorities, turned a blind eye to the covering in the sense that we did not remove the sculpture and we also did not investigate or prosecute those covering it up for vandalism. There were strategic and principal reasons for not doing this. We were concerned it would have led to worse vandalism, such as painting the sculpture. But more importantly, we decided instead to let the debate play out on the campus and for the sculpture to be the focus of thinking about race, gender, representation, the dignity of the subject, and the way it made some viewers feel. So while for some, such as the distinguished photographer David Goldblatt, who was abhorred by the covering and our failure to act against it, so offended was he that he removed his collection of photographs which he had given to UCT to keep and took them away. But people like David Goldblatt accused us of creating a climate in which, quote, it is impossible to deal with the past in the light of the erosion of evidence. For me, at least, the covering up led to far more debate about the past, far more insight into the history of Bartman, far greater coming to terms with her legacy than had ever happened before in all the years the sculpture had stood there without blankets and covers. The ongoing covering was an exercise in multicultural education, how some people feel today when confronted with those reminders, and how understanding on the parts of diverse cultural groups about the perception of sculpture as a repetition of the original humiliation. Indeed, prior to the covering, most people passing the sculpture did not even know who it represented and what statement it was making. But there were many whose views I deeply respect who didn't agree with me, often passionately so. A number of conversations were held with the artist himself, Billy Bester, who was deeply upset by the covering up. He eventually initiated a legal suit against the university, demanding that the sculpture be displayed uncovered on the grounds of our restricting his artistic freedom by causing the artwork to be presented and viewed in ways that were contrary to his intention, a view that an artist has the right to control the originality and authenticity of their work even when they no longer own it. Rather than contesting this, we agreed to move the sculpture to a gallery venue as opposed to a public space where it could be displayed alongside and contextualized and better protected. But in particular, it could be displayed alongside photographs, full-size photographs, of the sculpture as it had been robed, with comments on why people had robed it and disrobed it. A public dialogue was held focusing on the Sarah Bartman sculpture, seeking more input from the university community. The recommendation from the task team is to differentiate between public spaces and private or gallery spaces. In the public spaces, people have no choice about what they view, and it is much harder to contextualize the art with explanations and related artworks. In gallery spaces, people can choose whether they wish to view the specific artworks or not, and when they do, the works can be explained and placed in context. The most controversial works of art, then, would be displayed in galleries, or should be, and no art should be removed altogether or censored, should be hidden away or censored. The third encounter is around different cultural practices. The story of the sheep. I received a call one afternoon in 2015 from a local resident who lived opposite a university building known as Avenue Hall. Avenue Hall had been occupied by the Fallist protesters for many months. It is about a kilometer away from the main university in a quasi-residential area. The neighbours reported that there was a sheep in the Avenue Hall yard, tethered to a tree, and they presumed that the sheep was about to be slaughtered in the yard. They were outraged and demanded that the university do something to prevent it. The students confirmed that they intended to hold a celebration or rally in the garden and intended to slaughter the sheep as a ritual cleansing and part of a celebration. They argued that this was their culture, that decolonizing the university meant respecting their traditions and not imposing our Western sensitivities on them. That becoming a more inclusive space meant creating space for them to slaughter animals ritually. Our initial reaction was to try to stop the slaughter. We first looked to the municipal bylaws and called the municipality in. Surely killing of animals to eat or for other purposes must be restricted to abattoirs. Not so. It appears the laws make provision for people to kill animals on their own private property. But, in terms of the municipal bylaws, the landlord of the private property has to give permission. In this case, the private landlord was the university. So we could not pass the buck to another authority after all. With further research, we also learned that ritual slaughter has been recognized by the Commission on the Rights of Culture and Religion as a fundamental part of the culture of some groups in South Africa and essential to their identity. There are also laws for the protection of animals against cruelty. But unless cruelty is defined as any killing of animals, and most of us sanction that by virtue of eating meat, it cannot be applied selectively in a case such as this. The affirmation by the students that they had an experienced person to do the act would have made singling out these slaughters from the many others that do indeed happen all over the country, especially in rural areas every day, would have made this a targeted political action. Were there other grounds for disciplinary action? Not surprisingly, the university itself had no rules against slaughtering animals on campus. The only disciplinary rules available to us would have been to charge students for bringing the university into disrepute. But that would indeed be playing into their hands, acknowledging that the value system that should prevail on campus, but not elsewhere in society, should be that of the white community with its traditional sensitivities to ritual slaughter. Of course, this was a deliberate provocation on the parts of the students, and a statement that they were claiming back their identity, not hiding it, or submitting to colonial norms and sensitivities. This, as I said, they had argued was what was required of an inclusive campus culture. The slaughter and celebration went ahead. The animal's skin was hung up to dry, attracting flies and generating foul smells, generating further outcries from various constituencies and demands that the university should prevent future slaughters and discipline those involved. We did neither. But those decisions were controversial and unpopular with the mainstream of university staff, many students, alumni, and some publics, especially those middle-class white communities of Cape Town, from whom we draw many students. In their view, this was a sign that the university was becoming, quote-unquote, a third-world university, you know, used in the pejorative sense of standards are declining. This is the beginning of the end. We also did not react a year later when another sheep was brought, this time onto the campus, and slaughtered one evening on the balcony of the Student Union building, the Steve Biko building, largely as an act of provocation. The executive's response was to play it down, to ignore it, other than ensuring that the skin was quickly removed and the area cleaned up. These are the challenges to the cultural norms and values of the university, which have been largely the norms of white culture and the legacy of colonial culture. But by now there are also other sets of values and priorities, such as those who support animal rights, that had ethical objections to the slaughter. And in time, I think the university will have to develop its own set of rules for various customary and cultural practices, ritual slaughter amongst them. Curricula and decolonizing curricula. Curriculum reform is probably the most contested and complex area of decolonization debates. I'm not going to address the substance of this highly contested field. Frankly, I'm not well enough informed to do so, other than perhaps in my own field of medicine and health. Rather, I want to highlight the dilemmas it poses for university executives and leadership. When a group of black academics approached me, they're known as the Black Academic Caucus, to discuss the call for decolonizing the curriculum, they highlighted that this was something that had been on the university's agenda for years, with little evident shift. They argued that this was in part a lack of commitment from the university executive to see change and be more directive. For example, by incentivizing academics through reward or promotion systems to change their curricula or teaching practices in a particular direction. They asserted that the Teaching and Learning Committee, which is elected by Senate, would never support these sorts of decolonizing curricula because the Senate was still majority white and not persuaded of the decolonization arguments, let alone committed to them, and would never drive the decolonization agenda, and that such direction was needed from the executive. They argued that that a directive was required from the Vice-Chancellor that would require each department to engage with what decolonization would mean in their respective fields. The dilemma is that the fundamental value of academic freedom grants lecturers the right to teach subjects and disciplines the way they deem fit. It is not usually the role of university executives, vice-chancellors, to get involved or be directive about reading lists, balance of content, or epistemic frameworks. Even the Senate would not prescribe to individual disciplines how they should be taught. And Senate would rightly be jealous about its authority to appoint the members of committees that oversee the educational processes and critical of a vice-chancellor who threatens to usurp that role. The defense of such an approach to academic freedom is as important in protecting academics from government interference and political interference as it is from commercial interference, interference by donors, and by managerialist university leaders. So how, if at all, should a university leader respond to the call for decolonizing curricula or promoting any other curriculum or teaching reform? It seemed to me that some leadership was required because the group was quite right that there was no initiative, very little initiative coming from the Senate or its representatives in this regard. In the UC context, most Senate members who are by definition professors have studied their PhDs in universities in the colonial global north, have very close ties to those universities and colleagues, and very limited links to southern universities and certainly to African universities. The alternative perspectives are much more likely to be found among younger scholars and black scholars. My solution, way of balancing these pressures, was to agree to formalize a curriculum change working group which reported to me, but which would be black-led and black-majority membership, but with an understanding that all its meetings would be open to all who wished to attend, and that it would not replace the formal Senate structures, but would feed any recommendations it came up with into those structures. The purpose was to provide some resources so that the group could themselves develop a clearer vision of what decolonization would mean in different disciplines and for modes and different modes of teaching and assessment, and to back them, to give them the authority of my office in encouraging departments to hold workshops with this group in order to try and nudge the thinking of academics and students in those departments to challenge their received paradigms. But I did have to make it clear that ultimately the change had to be owned by the experts in the disciplines themselves. The Curriculum Change Working Group has completed its work over 18 months with patchy and, I think, in the end, rather limited success. Thus far, the success thus far generating a mixture of controversial reactions and disinterest. But it remains a dilemma for university leadership: how to fulfill what is probably the most important line in our job description, which is that we are supposed to provide academic leadership while respecting the academic freedom of individual academics. So to wrap up, the examples, and there are more, many more, from where these came from, I hope make some of the following points. The issues are complex for a variety of reasons. They reflect deeply divergent practices, values, and sensitivities of different cultural groups, different histories, and different power relations to the establishment. Some of these differences are about substantive issues, such as the attitudes to monuments, the perspective on particular historical leaders, the response to particular artworks, individually or in aggregate, cultural practices such as ritual slaughter, the balance between curricular content and epistemological approaches that are that dominate the globalized academic world versus those that are determined much more heavily by local histories and cultures. Those are substantive differences over the substantive issues. And there are also differences over process and governance issues, and what counts as a compelling argument, in particular, whether inclusiveness, this I think is the crux of it, whether inclusiveness requires simply that nothing in an institutional environment should cause offence to anyone, or if one, or the alternative that one accepts, that in an increasingly diverse community, there will be many elements that some or other group will take offence at, and that it is not appropriate to find the lowest common denominator. There has to be that on this argument. There has to be some other criterion, other than offensiveness or sensitivity, around which we still need to build consensus. But for now, as leaders of these institutions who have to make day-to-day decisions without consensus guidelines on what criteria should be used, these will remain taxing dilemmas. The examples I have shared share a common theme, namely the challenge to the historical approach to transformation, at least in South Africa. The approach to transformation in the decades before Rhodes Must Fall is argued by some surreptitiously to maintain the status quo, against which the alternative of decolonization has to be championed. The former, transformation, it is argued, is a project of assimilation, to make the newcomers to the institution more like us, and us means people like me, to change them so they would fit in with the dominant traditional culture of the university. It is about reconciliation, redress, affirmative action to achieve equity, academic support programs to counter the effects of schooling deficits, and ultimately the incorporation of those previously disadvantaged into the economic and power structures of society. By contrast, decolonization, while not unproblematic conceptually, holds an essential critique of the failure to challenge the validity of the old hegemonic cultural norms. Decolonization of institutional culture calls for a change in identity, for the creation of a new culture that is more balanced, a more balanced mixture of the diversity of the communities that make it up, at least the recognizing, but where appropriate, valorizing a variety of cultures, histories, languages, value systems, and ways of seeing the world. And finally, for the institutional culture to change, it has to be much more than the symbols on the walls, the symbols, the artworks on the walls, and the curricula. There has to be an internal, individual willingness to interrogate our own value systems, prejudices and blind spots, and inherent assumptions about ourselves, our histories and cultures and convictions that are tied up with our identities, but also about the other. If we can do that, then, maybe just then, the fall of Rhodes can begin to signify the re-emergence or the emergence of more inclusive institutional environments at institutions all over the world. Thank you.